Welcome to Today's Homeowner with Danny Lipford, your partner in home improvement. Everyone has questions about their home. We've got the answers, and we have a few laughs along the way. Informative, entertaining, and sometimes off the wall. Home improvement has never been this much fun.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Today's Homeowner Radio Show. You know, you're at the right place to get all the information you need to have the best-looking house on the block. Hey, I'm Danny Lipford, along with my good friend and co-host, Joe Truini.
Here we are at the end of closing in on the end of January and right in the middle of winter, but I think a lot of people are starting to think about the next few projects they'll be working on.
Joe, we also like to, you know, when we hear about something that's current and, you know, something that's very topical, we like to bring it to everybody's attention.
Right.
Even though sometimes it's not as positive as we want to be. We certainly want to be as positive as we can, as optimistic and as encouraging as we can, but I'm afraid the darn lumber prices are peaking again, and I've just got an email and a press release from the National Association of Home Builders, which pretty much has their, you know, hand right on the pulse of everything. And I hate to say it, but the prices right now are about as high as they've ever been, adding more than $18,600 to the price of a new home compared to last year. Now, that's just about unbelievable, isn't it?
It is, especially because it had dropped. It dropped quite a bit throughout the summer. And then I guess it was around the end of August, it spiked again. It went up 167%. I mean, it's still slightly lower than it was at the very highest. You know, so if you're looking to buy lumber and you didn't do it at the end of the, you know, at the end of August, I guess, or July, you know, you might want to hold off a little bit. They think there'll be a correction. The problem is there's still some supply chain issues. Lumber's not getting through. The wildfires out west not only wiped out the forest, but stalled the production of lumber. And then there's still tariffs on Canadian goods, and the Canadian lumber's not coming in. They put those tariffs on, I guess, about 6 or 7 years ago. I don't know why they're still on there, but Canada's finding other places to sell their lumber where they don't have to pay that tariff.
That's right, yeah.
So, yeah, I assume that, you know, it's going to start dropping down again, but when? I guess it's when the supply chains open up. And the reason the supply chains are down, of course, is there's still a pandemic and there's not enough workers out there to run the ships and the trucks and the mills and everything else. So I guess we just have to get healthier and hope by the spring things will change.
Well, there's you know, a lot going on behind the scenes, and certainly the group, the National Association of Home Builders, is working very, very hard with the legislators, with the government, with everybody to try to correct this bad sign that's going on. But just be patient. They'll take care of it, and hopefully good old American competition, competitiveness will help correct it even faster. But keep in mind, you know, some alternatives you can, I would check, you know, if you got a project, run by the ReStore, the Habitat ReStore. You might be surprised what you find there. Last time I was in there, I was blown away. I had no idea, first of all, that these stores had gotten so large. And also, there's a lot more in there than old used paint. There is a lot of good stuff in there. So check that out. Also, you'll be surprised through Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist, other places like that, that you'll be able to find exactly what you need for that bathroom or kitchen renovation or whatever that you might be doing. I mean, people have leftover lumber that they're trying to get rid of. They have leftover plumbing fixtures they're trying to get rid of. So a lot of ways that you can save money there without getting in too much too deep on things. So hate to give you that bit of news, but we're going to keep our pulse on it. Another thing we want to follow up with you, which we're going to in the next week or so, and we'll let you know, is the controversy about foam insulation and termite bonds. This is something we're getting a lot of calls about. We got a tremendous amount of response when we mentioned that on one of our podcasts. So we're doing a little research right now, so stay tuned and we'll get back with you of the positioning of everybody nationally pertaining to this kind of odd issue about potential termite bonds not being able to be issued on homes with foam insulation. It's a big one. It's a big controversy, and we'll try to cut through all of it and try to tell you exactly what's going on.
And the problem, of course, is when you start spraying foam, that foam's locked in there. How do you remove it to inspect the framing, you know, or roof sheathing or anything else if there's water damage in the roof? That they discovered, uh-oh, now we sprayed all this foam and we go to inspect it. If it was fiberglass or rock wool insulation, you just pull it out of the way, take a look at the lumber and put it back. Well, what do you do with foam? You can't just scrape it all out and then what? You know, so that's where they're running at the problems.
Yeah, there's a lot of angles on that, a lot of different ways that you look at it. And, of course, the termite problem is not going away. It's as bad as it's ever been. And I certainly would hate to be in that business. I have repaired hundreds and hundreds of houses with termite damage, and none of that is any fun. That's the kind of projects you don't want to do. Things like kitchen fires, termite damage, things like that. You know, you want to do projects where I've dreamed about this master bathroom or bedroom for years, and now I'm finally getting it going. That's the kind of projects that are a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, I'm in Connecticut, so thankfully we have very little termite problems. About 3 degrees out, no termites around here. We have other issues, but no termites.
Well, I'll tell you what, Joe, I've got my hands full over the next couple of days, headed up to Birmingham, Alabama, where two of my daughters live. And of course, they have significant list for Dad to take care of. So, so I talked to him, you know, and I wanted to get the two different lists because now I'm having to balance that. So I'm putting one day in at one of my daughter's houses and one day in at my other daughter who just bought her very first house. So, you know, they're excited about the little things. They know how to do it. They're putting their list in order of priority. And then they know I'm going to ask, okay, do you have this material? Do you have that? And, you know, Melanie, my middle daughter, who just got married recently, as you know, told me something I've never heard quite put this way before.
What's that?
I said, well, do you have the drill? Do you have the drill bits? Yes, I've got that. Do you have, you know, the flat bar? Do you have the cords? And she said, Dad, I'm married into tools. So I've got plenty of tools. And I go, what you say? I've never heard anybody marry. You know, you hear the old saying about, well, she married into money.
Right.
Well, she's kind of chuckling at it. She goes, Dad, I'm married into tools because her husband is in construction business. So he's got plenty of tools. So I don't have to take any tools up there.
Oh, good.
I was assured that she'd have everything I need.
Married into tools. Sounds like a movie title, maybe. We'll have to work on that.
Yeah, it might be. If you'd like to reach out to us, we make it really easy. 800-946-4420 is the Today's Homeowner Hotline. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're able to ask us any question you like. And you also can leave any comment or any thought that you may have that you want us to cover on the Today's Homeowner Radio Show. You can send us emails anytime. todayshomeowner.com/ask. Right now, we're going to go to New Hampshire. We get a lot of wonderful calls from that great state. And Ken is on the line. Ken, welcome to the show. And tell us what's going on around your house.
Hi, guys. Love your show. My wife and I have built a new home. And we installed Kurgo Outlast laminate flooring in the main part of the house. And now the issue we're having is some of the planks have separated on the ends, not on the long side, but just on the ends. And I'm not sure why that's happening. And I'm concerned about is how much of a job it will be to reconnect those planks.
Now, Ken, this is a traditional floating laminate floor, so nothing is glued down to the floor.
That's correct.
Well, you know, normally what happens there is that it's a matter of shrinkage, that it's just the material is installed, and then after air conditioning and heat and the relative humidity in the home goes down to, you know, what is usually an accepted level of 35% to 50%, a lot of times materials will shrink just a little bit, and it'll show up in the butt joints more so than it will the long joints. And that's, I assume, what's happened here, because it's not likely it's any type of movement in the floor or anything along those lines. You know, I have seen situations where you're able to take, you know, go to one end. Now, you might have to take some shoe molding down in order to use a flat bar to squeeze these things back in. But as strange as it sounds, and this is going to seem a little odd, but I have done it personally, and that is with a pair of tennis shoes on, you're able to kind of scoot that board back together. Depends on how long it is, but you're actually able to just kind of jump and push that board. We used to kid around about stretching carpet that way, but you actually can do that. I know it sounds a little funny, and you certainly will look funny when you do it, but that possibly can tighten those joints back up together.
My concern is I'd have to remove baseboards and, well, the major problems are right near the entry door, so I understand the temperature change and the shrinkage there probably when you open the door, and it's cold here. I mean, it's 29 degrees today. And I don't know if that makes any difference or whether it seems the main problems are where the runs are the longest. The house is 48 feet long, and on the sides, these planks are running probably 36 feet. I don't know if the length of the run makes any difference.
Well, it would. There's just more material there and more that can shrink. There's a, the thing about it, either it's going to go together very easily or it may be near impossible to do without removing the shoe molding or the baseboard in order to pry against the wall. Joe, any tips on this?
Yeah, Ken, what I would suggest, first of all, this is not unusual with laminate flooring, and thankfully it's not along the long edge, because that's a separate issue altogether. And the way I've found, you can try Danny's tennis shoe technique and see if that works. If you have a lot of boards, a lot of planks, and you have to move a lot of them, you may wear out your shoes before you get everything back in place. But if they don't move, what you can do is take about a 12-inch long 2x4 and put a piece of double stick tape on the bottom, then stick it down to the plank that you want to move. Then just tap it with a hammer. You know, put your foot on it, by the way. Stand on top of that 2x4 so it doesn't move. Just tap it. That'll usually move. Now, of course, when it moves, it's going to create a gap at the other end. So you have to do, if this one's 3 planks from the end of the wall, you have to move 3 planks because you're going to move them all. And you can actually try if the joints aren't too tightly together, which they should be, but if they will move, you might be able to move, go back 2 or 3 planks and tap it and see if it moves 2 or 3 planks to close that gap. And if you're really lucky, any remaining gap will be under your shoe molding.
Excellent.
Right? Because as you said, you don't want to really remove the shoe molding if you don't have to.
Right.
So there should be a gap around the room anyway. It should be a 1/4-inch gap. The shoe molding should be at least 5/8 of an inch. So you would have room to move it.
Right.
To where you wouldn't see the gap now under the shoe molding.
All right. I'll try those techniques, and hopefully I can get this accomplished without removing baseboard thresholds.
Good. Well, we certainly hope so. I think you'll find that it'll work pretty well. And then the good thing about it is once you get it corrected, it's not likely to happen again now that it's got acclimated to your house. So best of luck on that. And we appreciate you being a part of the show today.
Well, thank you very much. And I do love your show, and I will listen to you regularly. Thanks much.
All righty. Thanks so much, Ken. We appreciate that. Well, Joe, your idea with the double stick tape probably would work okay, but not near as much fun as getting the tennis shoes and doing a little jig on that floor like that. And, you can put whatever music I would recommend, something, a faster music. I mean,
right. Not a soft shoe.
Perry Como thing might not
Perry
do it.
Perry Como. How far down did you reach in your memory bank to come up with Perry Como? Wow.
I just always like that name, Como.
Yeah, that is kind of a cool name.
That's pretty good.
It sounds like an abbreviation. I suspect that was a longer name. But with Ken's problem being a brand new house, there also, of course, is a lot of movement in a brand new house as everything's starting to settle and release moisture and everything else. And if this flooring wasn't acclimated to the room, as you had referred earlier, because whenever you bring in new flooring, it should always sit in the room in its original packaging. I'm not really sure why that is, but it shouldn't be open. It should be sitting in its original packaging for up to 2 weeks or so. I don't know how it acclimates when it's wrapped in plastic, but anyway, that's what the manufacturers recommend.
Well, I tell you what, I went to extremes here on my new house when acclimating everything, including the trim, because so often, you'll install crown mold, and I've got lots and lots of trim in the house, and I didn't want to have all of those gaps. So right. As soon as I got my windows and doors in, and of course, one of the doors I had a special order, I had to wait a while, I put up 2 layers of plastic there. I put a dehumidifier in the center of the house. I put a drain line going straight into one of my drains, and I kept that thing running 24 hours a day. I know it cost me a little bit in electricity because dehumidifiers will use a lot of electricity, but I kept that going the entire time, and I had, of course, a hygrometer to check to make sure I was keeping it down below 50%. So anything that I brought in, early. I brought in thousands of feet of trim. I brought in all of my doors, all of my millwork, all of my floors, everything in there, and I knew that it would stay dry. And I made everybody keep the doors, closed.
Right.
And it was pretty warm in there sometimes, like a dehumidifier will do. But I'm telling you now, a year and a half, 2 years later, I don't see any separation in my floors, in my molding, and some of this crown molding, so 7 and 8 inches, which has a lot of wood there.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I'm telling you, that little going to that extreme will certainly save you, a lot of trouble down the road.
Yeah, and plus you had a brand new slab floor poured, and those are continuously releasing moisture as well, more than you might think. So, like you said, anything you can do to get that moisture out of the house will work out in your favor in the long run.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Just a few of those little things like that certainly can make a big, big difference. Okay, well, let's see if we can help homeowner. Joyce is with us right now on the line. Joyce, welcome to the show, and tell us what's going on around your house there.
Well, thank you for having me. I just built a new house about 3 years ago, and not looking at the plans very well, my carport is about 3 foot away from coming flush with the end of my house. So I have about a 3 foot by 10 foot area that the water comes off of the roof really bad in that corner. And I want to put a rain barrel up there, but I want to do something with the rest of the area that makes it appealing. The thing is, my carport is used more as a porch or patio. We don't put the car under it. So my family comes off and on the carport at that end. So bird baths wouldn't be good or anything like that. I just want something to make it appealing.
Okay. Well, you know, when you have an area like that, whether it's a carport or a garage, you always want to reserve the use of it for that purpose, you know, so utilizing it and having things there and not parking the car there is fine. But in the event that you want to park it, you want these things to be able to be moved away. And I think that's what you're speaking about, like bird baths, things like that would just be
right.
Too hard to deal with from that standpoint. First of all, that water piling down on that ground right there is not a good thing. You don't want that water to cause a problem with your foundation eventually. So this might be
right.
A good place for gutters. And, you know, you can have gutters sized up a little bit. You can get the continuous aluminum gutters in 6-inch instead of 5-inch, and it won't look, you know, overbearing or gaudy or anything there. And then while they're there doing that, you can go in and have them route the downspout right into that rain barrel. And I love rain barrels. Have the faucet on the bottom of them, have the little overflow
right.
Where, you know, it overflows. I think it's a great idea. Sometimes you may want to put a little bit of screening in front of that, whether it's a little bit of lattice with some vines or some type of plants can make that. But, well, I mean, the first thing that people would recommend there is landscaping. You mentioned that shrubs would not be an option because that would warm the area up and make it look a lot better and maybe, you know, give just a little more privacy, but you don't feel like shrubs would be a good idea there?
No, because like I said, we live on 10 acres, so we're off and on all sides of the carport. And the garden is actually behind the carport, so my husband and my kids run off and on the carport all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So shrubs would, you know, they would run into them.
Sure. Well, I tell you, so it's a great situation to expand that slab just using pavers. Move the grass out of there, and then you're able to put, you know, pavers that are level with the slab. And I see that you have some bricks there, so you can get a paver that has a similar color to your brick so that it doesn't stand out. And that's a pretty do-it-yourself friendly, fairly easy, inexpensive way to gain that 3 foot on your carport area. And it would also hold up very well for any water that might get on there. And that moves that water away from your slab a little bit more. That may be a good option.
Well, it's about a 6-inch between the ground and the slab in some areas.
Uh-huh.
What would I put underneath the pavers? How would I build it up?
You can just use the paver base. It's available in bags and it's very inexpensive. And that's the material you want to put down before you put the pavers on anyway. So that's what I would do. I would line that out. And there's plenty of instructions on exactly how to do that paver extension at pavestone.com, as well as our website, todayshomeowner.com.
Okay.
And like I say, it's pretty easy and be kind of a nice little accent over there for that 3-foot by 10-foot area.
Yeah, that, like I said, I have kids, I have grandkids that are running in and out all the time, so that's why I knew trees and shrubs and stuff like that wouldn't work. But how would I put a border for the pavers?
Yes, uh-huh. You would normally put an out. I mean, there's a lot of different ways and a lot of different, just like you have the brick roll-lock that runs along the patio now, you can do the same kind of effect with the pavers.
Okay.
Just build it right up. You won't have to use any concrete, and most likely you'll have very little cutting, if any, if you lay those pavers out just right.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good idea. I will talk to my husband, and I think that'll be our spring project.
There you go. Well, good, Joyce. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Today's Homeowner Radio Show. And if we can help you again, just let us know.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. All right. Our pleasure. Well, Joe, I kind of dominated that one. Next segment, I'm just going to let you talk and tell stories.
You sure? Okay. You always say that, but it never happens.
So I'm just always kidding around.
The only thing I was going to add is the other option Joyce has, of course, just build a nice deck there.
Yeah.
Because if it's dropped down 6 inches, a deck, put either pressure treated or composite lumber on top. You don't have to worry about splinters. It'll last forever. So that's the other option.
And you still could put some shrubs there. I didn't want to, you know, push that too far, but you could still put some shrubs there and leave a walkway.
Danny, she does not want shrubs. You keep pushing her on shrubs.
I know she doesn't want any shrubs
there. Those kids are going to be running at the shrubs.
Anyway, we want to go right to our email stack and We try to get as many of these done as we can. We'd love to hear one from you. Todayshomeowner.com/ask. This came from Roland in Ohio. Hi, Danny. We're having a little trouble with our toilet. The flush mechanism sticks after we flush, so it runs on and doesn't ever empty the bowl. Now, we watched an episode of your television show, and you mentioned some type of flush bowl system that you could get at Home Depot. Could you give us the name of the product? I hope it will solve our problem. I'm sure you're talking about a Fluid Master. A Fluid Master has a variety of different kits that are available, from complete rebuilding systems that you can use to correct any problem that you have, or if you've narrowed it down to just the flapper valve or the fill valve or the handle, then you can buy the individual components as well, and is waiting on you right now in the aisles of Home Depot, and very, very easy to take care of a lot of those problems. But it's a good idea to do it, Roland, because that can cost you a heck of a lot of money in your water bill if that thing just runs and runs and runs like that. Here's another email from Mike in Rochester, New York. A large section of my asphalt shingle roof has a 3-12 pitch. With all the snow we get here in upstate New York, I was wondering, should I rake the snow off the roof or let nature take its course? I'm a bit worried about ice dams. So, okay, Snow Joe, should it stay or should it go?
So this is a 3-12 pitch roof, I think he said. So That's pretty flat. It's only about, I think 3-12 is about 14 degrees or so. Yes, he should definitely rake the snow off. Now, this is assuming he can safely reach the roof from the ground. I wouldn't recommend getting up even on a ladder if the ground's covered with snow and ice. But I have a roof rake, and it has, I don't know, like a 16-foot long handle, so you can probably reach it. And you only need to pull the snow off the bottom 4 to 6 feet of roof, and that'll help prevent ice dams, because what happens is the snow melts, and it runs down the roof under the snow, hits the eave of the house, which is cold, and it freezes, and then the rest of the snow melting doesn't have any place to go, and it backs up, and that ice forms a dam, which is why I call it an ice dam, and it backs up and gets under the shingles, believe it or not, goes up the roof, and will leak into the house. So yes, if you can, definitely pull the snow off the roof.
And I'll tell you, those snow rakes are pretty neat. I mean, they can telescope out. I think I used one time that was 20 foot long. Wow. And very lightweight. And you just lay it there, and you might not get 100% of the snow off, but you're getting the majority of the
most
weight.
Of it,
so
yeah.
Good one there. Here's another email from Dylan in Gillette, Florida. Hi, Danny. I heard you discussing the importance of changing the rotation of ceiling fans during winter. Can you tell me which position the switch is supposed to be in to circulate the heat? Well, Dylan, I don't know if it's up or if it's down, but what you want is for it to be turning clockwise is the most important part of it. As you're looking up at the fan, it should be turning clockwise to push the air up toward the ceiling. And as I've mentioned a number of times, if you've ever been up on a ladder doing some work in any room, any time of the year, it's a lot hotter up there near the ceiling than it is down where you're walking around on the floor. So pushing that hot air and having it return back to the lower part of the room just makes sense as far as your comfort level. Always use it on low. You don't want to, to push it too hard, but you do that and I guarantee you'll immediately see a big difference. All of these were emails that came in at todayshomeowner.com/ask, and you can do the same thing. Joe, what about that simple solution? Come on.
All right, I have a quick tip on removing a damaged peel and stick floor tile without damaging any other tiles. That's the key. I mean, sometimes you can use a pretty aggressive method and you wind up damaging another tile, and now, the problem's compounded. So first thing to do is cover the damaged tile with two layers of paper towel, just dry paper towel, then set a hot clothes iron on top of the paper towels. No steam, just the hot setting without the steam, and just slowly move it back and forth. And what you're doing, of course, you're heating up that tile, which will loosen up the adhesive below. So move it around. I mean, depending on how old this tile is, it might take 5 or 6 minutes. If it's a relatively new tile that you put down, it might only take a couple of minutes. But in any case, move it around and then slip a putty knife under one corner and see if it's starting to loosen up. And little by little, you'll see that the glue will release and you can peel up that tile and replace it. And what you're trying to do is let that surface dry if you need to clean it before you stick down the new tile. And by the way, the other tip, if you're just starting a tile project and you want to use these peel and sticks, as Danny said, they're really easy to put down. They're lightweight. You move one at a time. But the big advantage is exactly that, Danny. If there's a stain or a damage or scratched up, or sometimes tables and chairs leave dents that don't come out, you can just remove those one or two tiles. But if you're going to buy them, buy the best quality, the highest price ones you can afford, because the cheap ones are not really square. Not to mention they're thin and they wear out, but they're not square. And that's the biggest thing. When you start laying these together, if they're not perfectly square, you end up with these tapered gaps between them that there's no way to fix. So that's the other solution is to, if you want to make the job go easy, buy really good peel and stick tiles.
Buying just a few extra ones.
All
because
of.
If you try to go back and match them later, you'll have a different run that will maybe be slightly different, or they discontinue them constantly. So just having two or three extra ones there are a great idea. And that goes for just about anything that you have in your house. I know when I built my new house, of course, I had tile left over, I had trim left over, and that's really the only thing that I have stored in my garage attic area is just the different little components here and there. And even though I've only been in here a short amount of time, I have gone in and gotten a few things here and there that I needed. And it's become very, very valuable. You hate to pay, buy too much and have too much left over because of the cost. But having a few pieces here and there and making sure that you save them and label them definitely makes a lot of difference there. So,
well, the days of buying extra lumber because it was relatively affordable, if you need an extra board or two, it doesn't matter. Now I see when I go into Home Depot, people are wheeling lumber back in.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because they've bought two or three boards too much. It's like, well, these studs are 10 or 12 bucks each. I'm not going to just let them lay around.
Well, it's just like some of these deck screws. I mean, these really good deck screws, $27 for, I guess it's a 5-pound box. And I know we're talking to my daughter, because I'm going there this weekend to do some work. She says, how many screws will you need? And I went, well, let's see. I guess I'll need probably about 15. She goes, good. I have 20. I'm taking the other box back. So that's a good example. I mean, why not? $27.
That's right.
You know, if you have some leftover screws and nails, it's kind of nice to keep them around, but not when it's almost $30 a box.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I have an old Ace Hardware store not far from here where you can still buy individual screws.
No kidding.
Big bins.
There you go.
So if you want to buy one screw, you can buy one screw.
The sound of you doing is music to our ears. Order on the Home Depot app and get convenient delivery, so you don't have to stop doing when you need something. The Home Depot app, how doers get more done.
It's time for our best new product segment brought to you by The Home Depot, how doers get more done. If you've ever had a light switch or a receptacle that was recessed into the wall a little too far, you know how annoying it can be. It leaves a gap between the device and the cover plate that is definitely not very attractive and can really make you a little nervous every time that you use this. A lot of times this can happen when you're installing a ceramic backsplash in your kitchen. And how do you really support that outlet or that device properly? Well, Rayco invented the Flush Fit Wall Plate Spacer to solve the problem. Flush Fit Wall Plate Spacer. The metal plate simply hooks behind the device and over the top mounting screw. Then it swings down behind the device to draw it out from the wall and hold it in the proper position for the cover plate. It works on any kind of switch, receptacle, GFCI, in single gang boxes to repair loose or recessed devices. So if you have sloppy switches or outlets and you just don't want to put up with them anymore, you can fix it with this particular device. So again, it's a Rayco 1 Gang Flush Fit Wall Plate Spacer. And you can find out more by going to HomeDepot.com. We get asked that all the time with questions about people installing the 1/4 inch or 3/8 inch thick ceramic, and they get to the outlets and you just don't know what to do. So
yeah,
there's the solution right there for you. Now, if you want to send us an email, you can do so at todayshomeowner.com/ask. And if you want to pick up the phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 800-946-4420. Joe, we got some great calls that came in on the hotline, so I think we need to jump right on them and grab one right now.
Okay, let's go.
I recently did a bathroom remodel and installed a shower and a bath exhaust fan. The bath exhaust fan I installed is for a 100 square foot bathroom, and this one is only 50 square feet because I wanted to make sure I'd remove enough moisture out of it. The venting pipe I used, flex pipe insulated, and that runs about 20 feet across the attic, and I have it coming out of a south side wall with a plastic hooded single flap damper. The weather has sometimes been around 20 below zero and that flapper will freeze down. And if I run the fan long enough, it'll thaw and open up. But the next day I repeat the process. And if it really gets cold and 30 below, it will not open up. My question is there any remedy to this, or would it help to add blanket insulation on top of the flex pipe in addition to the pipe being insulated? Thanks.
Wow, that you're talking about some extreme cold when you're talking about 15 to 30 degrees below zero. And I know exactly what he's talking about. First of all, it sounds like he's done everything right. Now, to have a vent pipe to go 20 feet in any situation, it'd be a lot better if it was a lot shorter route, because the longer that exhaust line is, the vent pipe, the less efficient that it'll be. But, of course, he's got it insulated. So, Joe, that little flapper, you know, that's just usually either very, very thin aluminum, or a lot of times it can be plastic. Do you know of any trick in order with those kind of extremes to keep that thing from sticking like that? Because you have, you know, you're exhausting moisture out, so there's bound to be, you know, a little bit of moisture on the flap at all times, just about.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden it freezes. Any thoughts on that?
Well, you're right. That 20-foot run is compounding the problem, because the heat has dissipated at that point. So it's not warm air exiting that flap or that damper, because at that point, after 20 feet, I'm sure that warm air from the bathroom is cooled considerably. So it's not keeping that damper warm at all. The only thing I've found that works, and I had this one problem, and the reason you want to keep it open, besides the fact that, you know, it's not exhausting the air properly, is that's putting strain on the motor. I mean, if that flapper's closed, this motor's running, the fan motor's running, trying to push that air, and it's not going anywhere. It's probably leaking out a little bit, but it's not flowing out smoothly. I would put, if you can get to this damper during the really cold part of winter, just put a little piece of something, plastic or a wooden stick or anything, to keep it from closing entirely. Now, the downside is, of course, that, you know, you have a little bit of air leakage through there, maybe cold air coming up, but that's the only thing I know, is to keep it from closing all the way so it won't seal, which is basically freezing shut, you know. So that's the only thing I would suggest. And he only needs maybe a quarter inch, something like a quarter inch. Maybe you drive in a screw someplace to keep the flapper from, I'm calling it a flapper, it's the damper, from going closed all the way. So I burned out a vent fan on my range hood one time from that exact thing. It froze shut, and the fan was running and running and running, and it, you know, all the times we were using it, I don't know how long it took. It probably took a, you know, few weeks or a couple of months, but it did eventually burn out the motor. And that was only going, you know, through the walls, 8 inches, not 20 feet.
It doesn't sound like the vent cover would be very accessible. If it was accessible, and you can anticipate some of that, you know, some of the de-icer, even some of the material that's used, like on windshields, could be sprayed on it. I think might be able to do it, but I would guess it is hard to get to, but maybe propping it open, as you're suggesting, or if it's you know, available, that he would be able to spray that. But pretty unique problem there.
Yeah, it is. And I know there's high temperature grease. And I suspect there's probably like low temperature grease, which is less viscous. And maybe if you smeared some of that around, it would prevent it from freezing. I'm not really sure. If you're living in a place that gets down to 20 or 30 below, I suspect there are materials that, you know, can be used in extreme weather like that.
That's right. Let's go right back to the Today's Homeowner Hotline.
Yes, Danny. I have a little situation. Pretty sure I've got a lot of calcium and lime build up in the bottom of my shower stall. I've tried scrubbing it with a pretty substantial scrub brush with bleach, and I also squirted a little bit of toilet bowl cleaner, because I know toilet bowl cleaner, all that stuff, has got a little bit of phosphoric acid, but I just wonder if anything else would take care of the lime and calcium. Okay, then.
Well, it is definitely a big problem. You hear about that a lot. We get a lot of calls and emails about that. I know the one of the products that we've used in the past, Joe, is, I think, Lime Away.
Lime Away and CLR,
right? Yeah,
which stands for calcium lime rust remover. Either of those. And if he wanted to try before going out buying anything, he could just try. I know he said he tried bleach, but bleach is the wrong product for that. For the calcium, you'd want to use distilled white vinegar. Spray it on the floor of the shower. Let it sit 15 minutes or so. Spray it again. Let it keep it soaked, and then scrub it with a scouring sponge. You know, kind of with like the little a nylon Brillo pad on it, and then reapply the vinegar if you need to, scrub it again, then wash it. And for any areas that you need to get in that the sponge won't reach, use an old toothbrush dipped in vinegar.
Something that I never realized, that, of course, we talk about white vinegar all the time, but you brought up a number of times the high test high test vinegar. That's right. Actually, I believe you said it was like 30% versus whatever normal vinegar is.
Yeah, normal vinegar, I think like 6 or 8% acidity.
Yeah, yeah. So when you talk about really attacking something, you know, like a shower and everything,
that might
be worthwhile. Because the thing about it is you're not using gallons and gallons of this stuff
when you're doing
a cleaning project like that.
Yeah. You'd be lucky if you used a half a cup or a full cup on a shower, depending on how big the shower is. But that would definitely work. If it didn't work, then you can go try Lime Away or CLR.
Okay, let's go right back to the hotline for another call.
Hi, yes, this is Rosie. My question is, I have a septic tank, and it's in the back of my yard, my house, and I would love to have it moved to build an add-on. My question is, if I move it, would it cause more problems? That's what I was told, that it'll cause more problems that I have. And I live in the country, but I'm afraid to move it due to the fact that I was warned it would cause more problems. So I don't know if you can help me or not.
It can end up being quite a significant project. First of all, you have health departments in almost any area, even out in more rural areas, that will dictate exactly how big your septic tank needs to be, the field lines, how it's to be constructed, and so forth. That would be the first thing I would find out is from your building officials if you have anything that regulates what needs to be done there. Now, when you abandon a septic tank, you traditionally will remove the lid, pump everything out of it, and fill it with a sandy clay so that you basically, most of the time, you can leave the walls in place, but you just go ahead. Now, that could interfere with your foundation of the addition, so that's something to consider as well. I would call a couple septic tank guys in your area and ask them. I'm sure they've dealt with it and something that they can lead you in the right direction. I actually had a house one time, Joe, that I was not aware when I bought the little house. It was a rental house that the septic tank was under this poorly built addition on the back of the house.
Oh, wow.
So the... At some point, the septic tank needed to be serviced. We looked around for it, found it under the house,
and
put a little trap door in.
Right.
And was able to access it that way. Not recommended, and certainly had to be remedied later on. That had to be abandoned and put a new one in. But hopefully Rosie can find a good septic tank man, septic tank contractor that's done this and can lead her in the right direction, because she's got to do it according to the rules, or it could really come back on you very poorly on that. Okay, that's a few of the calls that came in on the Today's Homeowner Hotline, and you can call in right now at 800-946-4420. Right now, we'll go to Florida. Virginia's on the line. Virginia, welcome to the show, and tell us how we can help you around your home.
I live, of course, in Florida, and it gets hot in the summertime. And my house is on a monolithic slab, which means it's solid. And we had some plumbing problems, and the plumber, my husband, put my repair plumbing lines overhead. And so, consequently, I get hot water from my cold water line, very hot water. I have a metal roof also.
Oh, I see. It gets pretty hot up in that attic, I'm sure.
Yes.
Now, do you know what kind of water lines they used? Are they, is it PEX or is it copper? Do you know?
They're copper.
Okay. All right. And I assume they're not insulated. They don't have a foam insulation.
No.
Okay. Well, copper's, very, very conducive to getting, hot in an attic space like that. And of course, you don't, really have to worry in other areas of the country. One of the big concerns is that they would freeze and then thaw and, have leaks all over the house. So you probably don't have to worry about that. But still, if the pipes are wrapped with the foam insulation, that's going to keep that cold water cold and that hot water hot as it moves from point A to point B. So even though you think of foam insulation around pipes to keep it from freezing, it actually works in the opposite way in your situation. So never fun to get in an attic, but the material is very inexpensive, readily available at Home Depot, and you can buy a few pieces that will fit the size of pipe that you have, which will be most likely either half inch or 3/4, and then just carefully wrap the entire, every single piece of pipe that you can have access to, and I think that'll immediately solve your problem.
With insulation wrapping.
Yes, with the black Black foam insulation. It just slips right around it and actually has a self-adhesive little strip on it that you just put there. And when you get to different turns or joints in it, you usually will have to do a little bit of cutting to make to navigate that, and occasionally have to put a piece of duct tape here and there. But that'll solve the problem. That way, you won't be the influence of that heat will not be heating up that pipe as it moves through the attic.
Okay.
Virginia?
Yes.
The only thing I would also check is if these copper lines are running right next to each other, because sometimes in a retrofit situation where they're running it through an attic or some other open space, they may just run them next to each other, and then, of course, you have heat transfer. If the hot water line is up against or very close to the cold water line, it'll transfer that heat, and it'll come out warm or hot. So when they're up there wrapping them with the insulation, putting on the rubber pipe insulation, if they find these lines are really close together, first of all, they won't be able to put the insulation on them if they're close together. But if they are, they should take off the strapping or whatever's holding them down, separate them a little bit, even just a couple of inches, and then wrap the insulation around them.
All right.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Virginia, our pleasure, and hope you have a great weekend. You know, I'll tell you what, people may not realize how often that problem with copper water lines in a monolithic slab. I've dealt with, probably 15 or 20 different scenarios like that.
Right.
One particular one, I remember they were talking about that their water bill just seemed so high and that they were walking across the floor. It was a vinyl floor with bare feet. And they were walking, all of a sudden there was a warm spot.
Right.
And then they walked over and it was back cool again. Walked back and it was warm and it was a concentrated area. And the unfortunate part of it, there's no way of tunneling under a monolithic slab, or I guess you could, but you shouldn't. So basically you're going in there with a jackhammer and jackhammering out a 3 foot by, like a 3 foot circle in order to get down in there to have the plumber repair that. And then you still don't have a complete comfort level because it's always just a little tiny pinhole. Where did that pinhole come from? And, of course, it's the deterioration. A lot of times this is well water that maybe is not filtered as well as a municipal water. But I'm telling you, and then that's what happens. Then you have to route those lines wherever you can. And generally people are trying to route them where they don't have to tear out as much drywall and so forth. So therefore it ends up in the attic or exposed in other ways.
Well, then that raises a question. You just built a brand new house on a slab. Did you run copper? Did you run PEX or what did you run?
I ran PEX everywhere because, the copper was just incredibly expensive. And, now that they've kind of solved all of the original problems with PEX, then I felt pretty comfortable with all of that.
Right. And running PEX through a slab, you should have very few joints at all, if that's your concern. When it's out in the open, you may have joints because, you're running different lines to different fittings and fixtures, but in the slab itself, it should be a continuous run of PEX, and you just hope no one punctures it before they pour that concrete over it.
Exactly. We're going to go right back to the Today's Homeowner Hotline right now.
You were my answer to my prayers today. You ran the recipe for removing wallpaper. I have vinyl wallpaper. The first coat has come off. The backing is still on the wall. You gave a way to remove it with your solution. I had it all copied down except for I got down to diff and I didn't have the rest of it. Can you repeat it, please? Thank you so much.
Right. We're certainly glad to do that because it really is an effective way. And we've shared this with a lot of homeowners over the years and have used it many, many times. I'm telling you, it will make life a lot easier when you're there about to remove that wallpaper. One layer, two layers, or three layers as we often take out. So I'm going to give you this, but remember, you can go to todayshomeowner.com anytime and just put in wallpaper remover in our internal search and it'll print everything out there. And you can also, while you're there, look at all of the videos and everything that you need. But here comes the recipe again. It starts with 3 gallons of hot water. And of course, you're putting all of this in a pump-up sprayer. 22-ounce bottle of DIFF. Now, DIFF is a wallpaper remover solution, and you use that as part of this formula. Then a 1/4 cup of fabric softener. We found that helps it to stick to the wall or stick to wherever you're taking that wallpaper off, and allow the other parts of this to work. Next one, 1 cup of white vinegar, and last, 2 tablespoons of baking soda. You just put this in the the pump-up sprayer, shake it up real good, and then really use it very, very liberally. Just keep pouring it on there and pouring it on there is really going to help a lot. And as we've also recommended, using a lightweight plastic, painter's plastic, and just stick it to the wall. It's going to stay on the wall. You don't need any tape or anything because the moisture is going to help it adhere it. And it just basically allows all of the chemicals to work, not really chemicals, but things you would find in your pantry to work away at all of that glue so that it will come down. And then just a little bit of persuasion with a 6-inch drywall knife, and you're ready to go back with more wallpaper, more paint, faux finish, whatever you want to go with there. You're able to strip it all down. And again, you can find that and anything that we talk about, you can find it at todayshomeowner.com. Right now, we're headed to Atlanta, where Scott is on the line. Scott, welcome to the show, and tell us what's going on around your house there.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me. Little backstory. My wife and I went through a remodel of our house, first floor, back over the summer. And at that time, we had transitioned a bunch of furniture and other things out of the house into the garage. And since then, we have a two-car garage, and we have a couple little kids and all of the stuff that comes with life. And we've been able to recapture one of the garage spots, but we haven't been able to capture the second. And our garage really is kind of a mishmash. Unfortunately, we don't have a basement, so it's kind of become our storage slash car parking spot slash workout area, and it's a jumbled mess. I'm one of those weird folks. I'd love to be able to park my cars in the garage again, but we need storage ideas, but we don't have a lot of room. So we're kind of in this weird place right now where it's like, well, what do we do now? What do we do next? That's why we reached out to the show and hoping to maybe get some ideas and see what we can do.
Well, what I'm looking at in the pictures, and I appreciate you sending that, is not the worst garage I've seen. So you've got a good opportunity.
At least you can
here.
Park one car. We've seen where you can't park either car. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Without a doubt. But I see a lot of things here. One thing I see here that kind of stands out to me, which I think I think I know the reason for this. Looks like you have a cabinet there that's probably about 5 foot tall, and you have a strap around it. I assume that is to keep the kids from tilting that over?
Yeah, it is.
Good.
That's become kind of a tool storage area for us, as well as, you know, screws, nails, things like that, things that we just don't want them to get into.
Sure. Well, I commend you for that, because that's something, the tilt over issues is something that a lot of people don't think about, you know, in large pieces of furniture, stoves, you know, different things inside your home that, you know, kids will pull those drawers out and use that as a ladder to get up and tilt right over. So great idea on that. Well, first of all, when you know, the first thing I'm going to mention in terms of garage is throw away as much as you can. Throw away, donate whatever you can, and purge as much as you can out of there. Only you and your wife can do that. Nobody else can. But after that, then trying to get as much of the material and the possessions off the floor is also the key thing. So, you know, you can go buy all kinds of metal and different types of pre-made type of garage things, and you can go online and you can look at all of these different ideas, but some of them are like building expensive cabinetry in your house, and that's not what you need or want out in the garage. I'll tell you, so many times I've used half-inch plywood and regular 2x4s and created 16-inch wide shelving. And 16-inch wide shelving will just about take care of everything, and you can get three runs out of one sheet of plywood. So that you're talking about one sheet of plywood will create a shelf that's 16 inches wide and 24 feet long. So won't take too many pieces of plywood nor too many pieces of 2x4 in order to get a lot of this material up off the ground. Now, with your doorways, most doors like this, and what I'm seeing is you have about 12 to 14 inches above the door. That's an ideal place to position the shelf directly on top of the door trim that will allow you to go across the door without interrupting it, all along the back wall, and then maybe even over around where the window is in that part of the garage. That alone was probably 30 feet of shelving. And then by the time you put everything up, and I like to paint the shelving. I usually paint it the same as the walls. have it up there. Then underneath there, you're able to hang your ladder, you're able to hang bicycles, you're able to hang a lot of things that you might need more ready access to. You have places to tuck your step ladder under, and just that simple one shelf running around there like that probably will solve the majority of your problems in here after you purge a few things. Now, which one is, who's the pack rat in the family, you or your wife?
It's more of her. she's not here to defend herself, so I'm going to say it's her.
That's what I thought you were going to do, but what I'm describing here, I mean, I don't know how comfortable you are in building shelving like that, but we have lots of information on our website, and it really is a pretty simple thing, especially if you get her or a friend to help you on holding it in place and so forth, because a lot of it you can build right on the ground, hold it up, put screws in it, some supports on it, and you're ready to go.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. I didn't even think of, you know, it's coming from the top down rather than from the floor up.
Sure, yeah. And that's also a key thing, that if you're able to prevent any supports from the floor itself, is just a lot better. That is easier to keep clean. It's easier to, that gives you more floor space. Get everything up off that floor that you possibly can. And always think when you're organizing things, put those things that you use the most, let those be, the most accessible things that you get. So think about that when you're putting your totes in there, hanging things underneath. But if you get that first shelf done and get it up, then you'll see some odds and ends that you can adapt here and there on different areas of the garage.
Okay, that's great. No, I appreciate it. That's a great idea.
Well, if you get in the middle of it and get stumped in any way, you know what to do. Just give us a call back. We'll be glad to guide you through it at any time.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
All right. Take care, Scott. It sounds like Scott is headed straight out to go to work on all of that.
Yeah, you're right, though. The first thing to do is purge. You know, you just have to throw out as much as you can, because he's got this out of the house. A lot of it is piled up in bags. Obviously, they don't need it that often that they can't maybe purge some of this. And any really large items, I see he has a large extension ladder and some bicycles. If you can find someplace else to store those, because how often are you going to use the extension ladder? That will free up a lot of space too, because it's hanging on the wall now, which is great, but that takes up, like, when it's collapsed, it's probably taking up 12 feet of wall space. So anything like that, store it outside.
It is so satisfying when you get something organized. And matter of fact, we're going in the aisles of the Home Depot with our buddy Danny Watson. Danny, I'll tell you something that is so gratifying, especially seems like this time of the year, is getting certain areas of your home organized. It just gives you so much back over the year.
Danny, you're right. And I got to tell you, I just finished my closet at my house. I redid it.
Oh, is that right?
And well, and I was thinking about it, which really makes this timely. You know, before the grass starts growing and we start gardening, this is such a good time to tackle these things inside where it's warm. But I didn't realize how happy I could be with having the closet and the shoes and all that.
Well, it affects you like every morning when I walk into my walk-in closet. I don't want stuff all over the place. I want it to
at least
appear organized, you know?
Exactly. No, it's the little things that make life better.
I agree.
Our winter storage event's going on right now. It runs through February the 27th, and you can save up to 25% off on storage and organization solutions. Stuff's going to be things, you know, like bike racks and garage cabinets, select laundry organization shelving, and so much more. So you want to take advantage of that.
Well, you know, when you get in the aisles there and you start looking at all of the organizational things that you have there, and of course all the storage bins, all the totes, everything you have there, you can really kind of put together your plan while you're there. If you got to look at your garage, look at your attic, look at the space, your closet and so forth a little bit ahead of time, and maybe a little drawing here and there. But boy, when you get in the aisles, it seems to all come together for you.
It really does. And I was looking at actually some of the totes this morning that we've got in, some of the really nice heavy duty ones that come with wheels, and makes it so much easier, especially if you're going to be storing like heavy things. You can go ahead and fill that and then roll it out to the garage. And some of these are built really nicely, so when you stack them, you don't have to worry about the walls of the tote getting compromised. They just seem like they hold up so much better. And since they're on sale, it's a great time to pick them up.
And, you know, a lot of the shelving units, people might get a little intimidated trying to get, you know, 2x4s and plywood and putting everything together. But these freestanding units now, you have some of them that can handle just about as much weight as you want to put on them.
You're right. And they're really easy to put together. I put a few together myself right after Christmas, and they're simple to install, but yet they hold a lot of weight. Danny, I also want to throw in there, I know sometimes this can be overwhelming to some folks, or maybe they're just too busy. So keep in mind that at homedepot.com/services, we do offer design and installation, custom closets, storage solutions, you know, for the person that's just might not have time or don't want to tackle it. You can also leave it up to us.
But, you know, the home services team, you know, you're taking advantage of the expertise of, hey, we've done this before. We had a situation like this. Here's what worked out great. Instead of feeling like you're maybe experimenting with some of the plans or some of the ideas that you may or may not have, that's where it really comes in handy to have the pros from Home Depot. Kind of, we've been there, we've done that, we know it's going to work well for you.
And they'll help you maximize the space that you have.
Great project, always gratifying. Always great to talk to you, Danny, and I know that you're busy there in the aisles getting everybody organized, so keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Danny. Good to be on.
That's absolutely true, Danny. Whether it's a bedroom closet or a two-car garage, you know, staying organized, first of all, it makes your life a lot easier, but you have to remember it's an ongoing process. You're not going to organize it and think, okay, well, that job's done. It's not like painting a bathroom where you have to do it another 10 years. You have to, if you keep piling stuff in it after you've cleaned it out, you know, you're going to be back to where you are, where you started. So to keep it clean, just, you know, make sure you're not adding anything to the, whether it is the closet, get some organizers if you need to buy or build some organizers, and then just try to maintain it. I mean, that's the only way I've been able to park two cars in our garage, mm-hmm. is by not, every time I start loading it up, I realize, well, it's only a matter of time until I'm parking outside. So, you know, start purging whenever you can.
And it really can be, can feel very overwhelming when you go out, whether it's a garage or, you know, a closet that you've neglected or whatever. But, boy, I tell you what, just wade into it. Just psych yourself up and say, I'm going to give it 15 minutes and see how it goes. By the time that 15 minutes is up, you're right. Hooked enough that you're going to keep going.
And sometimes you're literally wading into
it. That's right. Exactly.
Because you're up to your hips and stuff.
Let's get a quick email here from Bill in Missouri. Hello, Danny. As a hobby, I restore old steamer trunks, which are often painted. Can you recommend a good paint stripper that can remove several layers of paint? The paint strippers on the market these days just aren't as effective as the ones I remember using many years ago. Joe, you think Bill should try some of the citrus stripper? I mean, always pretty amazed at that. It's a little less caustic than some of the other real strong chemicals.
Well, what Bill's referring to is the old paint strippers were incredibly effective, but they're also toxic because they had methylene chloride, which were actually toxic enough that they could cause heart attacks in certain people, because if you breathe the fumes, it would deplete the oxygen level in your bloodstream. One of the very first stories I ever wrote for Popular Mechanics, we're talking about going back to like the mid-80s, was this exact topic. And I talked to a doctor, and he's the one who told me that's why they got rid of this methylene chloride, because it was causing heart problems. So anyway, that's all gone. But the newer strippers, when they first came out with them, they weren't very effective. They were safe and they're non-toxic. They were great, except they didn't strip paint. So yeah, the citrus strippers that have citric acid in them, there's one called Citrus Strip and Smart Strip, I think is one. So I would definitely try those first. Danny and I have both had good luck with those. If you need to step up, if that doesn't work, because Bill here is trying to go through several layers, he could try Clean Strip, which is a company that makes several refinishing and solvent products. They make one, it's called Xylol Xylene, and that's X-Y-L-O-L, Xylol, and then Xylene, X-Y-L-E-N-E. You can find that at any hardware store or home center.
But believe me, you need ventilation no matter what you're doing.
Yep.
If you can get it outside on your carport, if you get a fan blowing, if you're in your shop, open up every window and door, get a fan blowing. Don't take a chance. A respirator is a great idea. Eye protection. Let's all be safe on all those projects that we're doing around the house. You know, something we hear a lot about is how much everybody loves the simple solutions that Joe provides us each and every week. Joe, impress us again.
Okay, I'm going to try. Drilling holes in concrete, stone, brick, anything like that is a job that every do-it-yourselfer has to do sooner or later. So here's a way to make it as simple as possible. If you have a larger diameter hole to drill, let's say anything over 3/8 of an inch, 1/2 inch, something like that, you can save some time by drilling progressively larger holes with different size bits. So instead of, if you have to drill a 1/2 inch hole, instead of drilling it with a 1/2 inch bit, start with an 1/8 inch bit, let's say, or a 3/16 inch bit, and drill that out, then go to the next one and keep stepping up until you get to the diameter you need. You'd be surprised how much quicker that goes, especially if you don't have a hammer drill. Not everybody owns a hammer drill, not everybody needs a hammer drill. If you have one, great. If you don't, you can use a regular drill, electric drill or cordless drill. But that's the tip, is just use progressively larger bits till you reach the size hole you need.
You know, that absolutely works, and that's something we've gotten a lot of questions over the years about hanging certain things on concrete walls. Maybe you have a concrete wall you want to hang some wall art or something like that on. And it's very hard, especially if you're doing it a horizontal hole. I mean, if it's vertical and you're able to really put your weight down on it, it helps a little bit. But if you're doing a horizontal hole and you're needing a pretty good size hole for a lead anchor or whatever fastener you're going to use, you know, to go in there with that quarter inch drill bit and get the depth that you need and come back with a half inch, absolutely, it'll save you a lot of time. And it also is less work on the drill bit itself, right? Because those concrete bits are notorious, you know, for getting dull very, very quickly, and then you're headed back to the store. So another great simple solution from my buddy Joe Truini, and you can see over 550 of these videos right now by going to todayshomeowner.com/simple solutions. They just keep coming in, and we certainly get a lot of feedback on the simple solution because there's so many things around your house that you might be putting up with them. You walk by them every day, and that door swings open, and you don't know how to keep it closed, or this is happening, or that's happening. And you just go to todayshomeowner.com/simple solution, and you solve the problem. And Joe, it's okay if some of our listeners do, you know, try some of these, and then take credit if they go to their wife and
absolutely
say, hey, this came to me the other day, and it just the solution came to me, and I fixed this, honey.
Yeah. In a brilliant moment of clarity, I came up with this idea. Yeah, nobody else has to know. Danny does that all the time. He takes my simple solutions. He goes home, says, Sharon, honey, look what I just found.
It just came to me like a vision.
But he forgets that Sharon talks to me every now and then. So.
But she lets me go along with it. Hey, another way that you can see more simple solutions is to tune in to our television show each week. So go to todayshomeowner.com to find out where you can see it in your area. Hey, we really appreciate you spending time with us each and every week. I'm Danny Lipford, along with my co-host Joe Truini, our great engineer Dennis Gould, our excellent producer Glenn Johnson, and the whole Today's Homeowner family. Thanks so much for being with us, and we hope you'll come back next week. We'll see you then.